I know some of you have been praying for my brother-in-law, David. Like to thank you for that. A little bit of an update. He's doing much better. In general, he's a little bit of a rambunctious fellow. So once they freed up his arms the other day, he decided to pull his ventilator out before it was supposed to come out. But he's doing fine. He's now actually been able to talk some, and he's making a tremendous recovery. So a big thank you for that. We did start to hear a little bit more, some astonishing things where if the trooper hadn't been just a few seconds behind him on that road, he probably wouldn't have made it. He lost something like 2/3 of his blood, and normally people don't make it through that, and yet we certainly have seen and experienced God's hand of healing and providing for him. So I know my wife especially has coveted and appreciated your prayers in that, as well as for her whole family. So thank you. I'll begin this morning with a little bit of trivia. What do the following men have in common? Okay, what do the following men have in common? Elbridge, some of these I don't even know how to pronounce her name. That's embarrassing. Elbridge Gerry, George M. Dallas, William R. King, Hannibal Hamlin, Henry Wilson, William A. Wheeler, Thomas A. Hendricks, and Garrett A. Hobart. How many of you know what all these men have in common? Probably a couple of you, right? These all happen to be vice presidents of the United States of America. Vice presidents of the United States of America. Everyone knows the presidents they serve under, right? I even learned a song as a kid. George Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson. So I could actually remember all the presidents, but nobody sings songs about vice presidents. Everyone knows the presidents they served under, but their names, the names of these vice presidents, are mostly forgotten. They were surely important in their day, right? Important to the nation, important to the presidents they served under, important at the time, but now their names are lost in obscurity. I'm sure we could recall the presidents, but not even match the presidents that they served under to these vice presidents. Try to think of these vice presidents, and suddenly those names seem just out of reach. Mr. What's his name? Vice President who? Or consider one of our nation's great heroes, Paul Revere. Everyone knows the name of Paul Revere, and many of you probably know and maybe could recite some of the midnight ride of Paul Revere. How he bravely rode through the towns, right, calling out the British are coming, and some sort of lantern thing, and whatever happened with Mr. Paul Revere. But few actually know that Paul Revere was accompanied by three others named William Dawes, Samuel Prescott, and Israel Bissell. In fact, Paul Revere was actually maybe the least successful of these four. Even though he's the best known, he got captured. Actually, the most successful of them all was Israel. He rode four straight days, passing the news that the Redcoats were coming. Rode all the way from Watertown, Massachusetts, right, through Connecticut, through New York, over to New Jersey, and then into Pennsylvania, and eventually stopped at Philadelphia, a total of 345 total miles in 4 days straight. In fact, one of his horses actually died underneath him because he was riding so hard and so fast. This horse dies from exhaustion, and he continued on. When he finished his ride, well, he took a nap, apparently, his first sleep in 4 days, and then returned and fought the war beside his brother in Connecticut. And maybe it's a mercy, frankly, that he died in 1823, 40 years before Longfellow would publish his poem about Paul Revere. And a few people would say, weren't there a couple other guys involved? Maybe, I think, yeah, but I just can't remember their names. Right? Without those other writers, especially Israel, who knows how prepared, right, the other states would have been, the entire nation would have been, to fight off the British. And yet today, this great hero, Israel, his name is forgotten while we remember the name of Paul Revere. These unknown, unsung heroes existing throughout history, American history certainly, through history as well. Those people whose names, they're just past recalling. They just don't seem to have been that important to really justify committing their names to memory. Those unnamed few who had a great impact. And in fact, we see the same thing in the Bible, right? There are some important figures who it's almost in some ways shocking that we don't know their names. Right, important figures who never get named in the Bible. So like, who were the shepherds at the birth of Christ? Right, these were the first people ever on earth to see Christ, to see Jesus, and yet unnamed. Or a question like, who was the young boy or whatever who provided his lunch so that 5,000 people could be fed? What was the name of the widow who gave all that she had? Or the names of the prodigal son and the father? What was the name of the criminal who was on the cross next to Jesus? These unnamed people who are right there on the tip of your mind, but no, they were never actually named. And all these people play key roles in the biblical stories, and yet their names are unknown to us, but, to be honest, surely well known to God. Unknown, but faithful. Unknown, but serving. Unknown, but key to the success of what is going on around them. And that's what we find as we dive into Nehemiah 11. We find a list of people sort of unknown in a way, but faithful. Some of their names here are committed, are actually shown, are actually in the text, but there's a vast majority here whose names never appear. Without whom, the restoration of Israel would not have been possible and would not have happened. If you're tracking with us in the book of Nehemiah, you find that we come actually to another turning point. Right? As we think back on the book of Nehemiah, the first six chapters tell us of the great rebuilding of the wall. Right? We start with Nehemiah, a cupbearer to King Artaxerxes, and then he hears the news that the city of his forefathers, the city of the God he obeys, right? The city of Jerusalem is in ruins. No gates, no walls, it's in rubble still. And so he decides to make the trip, and he travels all the way from over in King Artaxerxes' court. He travels all the way over, and he gets there, and he gets to Israel, and he motivates the people, and they rebuild the wall in 52 days, this incredible feat. So the first six chapters tell us about how they rebuild the wall. And then you get to chapters 7 through 10 that really tell us about these steps of rebuilding and restoring a people. And suddenly in chapters 7 through 10, you have this crazy month, it seems, of action after action after action, where the people gather and they hear God's word, and then they obey it by following the festival of booths just 13 days later. And then after that, you have them getting together and committing. You have this entire day of confession that leads to this signing of this committed covenant that says, we will obey. And we've had this basically month-long energetic, thriving revival of sorts, where the people suddenly see God's word, they see God's law, and they're told God's law, and they say, in response to God's law, we want to obey, we want to confess, we want to commit. And at this point, between chapter 10 and chapter 11, you sort of have the beginning of the end of the book of Nehemiah, in a way. You have another clear cut where this motivated, inspired revival sort of comes to an end. And now at the end of a revival, we start the long, unknown stretch of just living everyday life in relationship with God. And the question sort of becomes, how is the revival going to stay alive? Who is going to actually follow through on these commitments that they've made to the Lord to obey every command that he has given them? How is this going to keep going? Who's going to keep the momentum moving? And immediately they run into a problem, and it's a problem for them. And it may be kind of hard to see as a problem for us, but as they finish this revival and they're wanting to now begin to just live in a covenant relationship with God, having made this commitment, they run into a problem. And the problem is this, that although the city walls are rebuilt, although the gates are standing, although the fortifications on the outside of the city have been rebuilt, the problem is there's hardly anyone living inside the city. The city is basically empty. And this is a real problem, right? As we read Nehemiah 7:4 told us that the city was wide and large, but the people within it were few, and no houses had been rebuilt. And so you say, why is this a problem at all? Because Nehemiah 11 is going to tell us of sort of who is willing to go fill the city. But question is, why does it matter that the city isn't full? Why does it matter that the city isn't teeming with people? And for this, we need to understand, right? We need to understand the 5th century BC Israel. We need to understand what it was like living in Israel, living under that relationship with God. Right? What it was like to live in an Old Testament covenant relationship with the people with God and the people of God. The many issues in these commandments, many issues in the law, many of the issues that they were committing to obey are centered around the temple and are centered around Jerusalem. That the temple is so key to the success of the people and their relationship with God. That is where sacrifices are made. This is where they come for teaching. This is where the priests and the Levites, right? This is where the religious leaders serve. And people have to come to the temple in order to embrace, in order to fortify, in order to build up their relationship with the Lord. Much like a church today, right, is a location where people go to learn and encounter God. The problem is that if the city is empty, then who is there in the city to care for the temple? Who is there to make the life around the temple work? Who's there to provide food for the people who live in the temple and work in the temple? Who is there to worship in the temple? Who is in the city? That if this is really the restoration of the people of Israel, Jerusalem is the center of the people of Israel. It is the center of the nation, but it is the center of the people socially, culturally, and religiously. That this is God's holy city. It is the capital city, and it needs to be thriving. Because in order for the temple to thrive, the city needs to thrive. And for a city to thrive, there need to be people inside of it. So it needs to be populated. Right? Imagine if the USA were conquered tomorrow and they destroyed Washington, D.C. How could we survive as a nation? Actually, based on the presidential candidates right now, maybe this wouldn't be such a bad thing. So maybe that's a terrible example. But we need to get to Jerusalem, right, in Israel. In Israel, this capital city of Jerusalem was key to social, cultural, and religious life of the people of Israel. And so the city needs to be thriving. It needs to be filled. It is really the heart of the people of Israel. And for their relationship with God to thrive, right? They need the temple to thrive, and they need the city to thrive. So the fact that they've rebuilt the walls is great because now it allows people to live inside it, but we need the people to be there. But few are living within the city. And you say, well, if Jerusalem is so important, why are there so few people living in the city? Why is this problem existing? Why didn't everybody, when they come back, why didn't they just move into the city? Well, as we read a description of Jerusalem, as we think about what Jerusalem must have been like, if no houses are rebuilt and the city had been conquered and destroyed, right, most recently by the Babylonians, and the question is, what would the city have been like? Well, there are a couple issues with moving into the city. Issue number one is that the city would be the most dangerous place to live in. Right? If another nation is going to come conquer Israel, they're going to go to Jerusalem. Right? You don't go around conquering the outside towns. You conquer the city of Jerusalem because you know that it is the heart of the nation. So even though they've rebuilt the walls, the city of Jerusalem is still not secure because there's nobody there to defend it. Walls are great, but if there's nobody defending the walls, then the enemies just climb up over the walls and attack whoever's inside the city, the few that are there. And then they can just tear down the walls and there's nobody to defend the walls. And so one reason why people wouldn't have moved directly back into Jerusalem is it'd be the most dangerous place to live. I know. It's a scary place to be. Right, I wouldn't want to move there either if I know it's the most dangerous place. So you say, well, that'd be one reason, right? They're not moving into Jerusalem because it's the most dangerous place to be. Also, you have to realize this city has been empty for 150 years, and the last time it was populated, it was destroyed. Right? What happens when houses and walls and things get destroyed? There's just rubble everywhere. So anybody who was going to move back into the city had their work cut out for them, even if they rebuilt their house, right? The streets are probably going to be full of rubble. There's not going to be anybody to actually encounter and trade and barter with and live near. So anybody who was going to move into the city had a ton of work cut out for them because there's rubble everywhere. And we have to realize that while the city is now rebuilt, the people, many of the people, had moved back before the city was rebuilt. Those people who moved back, where did they live? Well, they lived in the suburbs. They lived outside of the city walls where there was actually life and people, and they could have farms and grow food and actually survive. If you moved into the heart of the city, you didn't have a farm there. You weren't growing crops. Right? You're in a city. It's just rubble. So nobody's moved back into the city. They basically all, when they came back, moved into the suburbs and surrounded the city. They're nearby, but they're not in the city, and this is a problem. Because we need the city to be full so that God's people can thrive, and so that the temple can thrive, so that they can actually continue just living now in an everyday, normal relationship with their God, who they have committed to obey. No houses to live in, a dangerous place to live, no real means of sustenance. There are walls there, but nobody to defend them. So who's going to want to move into a city like this? But there's a good reason people didn't move in. It's going to be a pain to live there, especially at first. And this is where the rebuilding effort stands as we finish Nehemiah 10. The walls have been completed. The people have been restored in that they have heard the word of the Lord and made a commitment to follow him. But now what? How is the everyday life of a relationship with God going to move forward in Israel? We need people to live in the city. And so we come to Nehemiah chapter 11, verse 1. Nehemiah 11:1. Now the leaders of the people lived in Jerusalem. So here we know that there are some people living in Jerusalem, right? When Nehemiah 7:4 told us that the city was rebuilt, but there were few living in Jerusalem, we find out that the few are the leaders, right? The politicians, the kings, the rulers, those people who really need to be in the city are living in the city. Which says something about leadership, right? The leader is, look, it's not any easier for a leader to move rubble and rebuild houses than anybody else. And yet here are the leaders moving in first. The leaders have lived there. They know the importance of Jerusalem, and so to show the people, right, to be an example for the people, the leaders live here in Jerusalem, as they should. Leaders need to lead. They need to go before. And here they are in the capital city where they ought to be, doing what they should be doing, the work of rebuilding the city from the inside. But of course, the leaders can't do it alone, and leaders, by definition, are few, and followers are many. So there are few people living in the city, but they are the leaders of the people. Now, the leaders of the people lived in Jerusalem, and the rest of the people cast lots to bring 1 out of 10 to live in Jerusalem, the holy city, while 9 out of 10 remained in the other towns. And so the leaders come together and they say, Jerusalem needs people. It needs to be populated. What will we do? And so they instigated a draft. Right? Much like an army draft, they said, well, people don't want to live in Jerusalem. It's dangerous. It's hard work. There's nobody here. They don't have neighbors. Right? It's lonely. And people don't want to live in Jerusalem. How do we get them here? For the good of the people, we just need to draft people. And so they cast lots, and 1 out of 10 is brought in. So 1/10 of the people of Israel who have moved back move into the city. Now the city is wide and large. It's a huge city. But clearly 1/10 of the people isn't going to fill it, as we can tell from the next verse. Right? But here we are, and as we think about numbers, many of you probably want to know numbers, right? How many people are moving in? The best estimates from people who are studying this is probably that around 1 million Jews returned to the area when they were allowed to return. And so 1 out of 10, you may be talking about a huge number, 100,000 people, as many as 100,000. Right? Those are the high sides of the estimate, are moving back into the city of Jerusalem. That's probably too high, but, you know, we're trying to guess from numbers that we're reading. And so you have a huge amount of people who are forced, who are asked very amicably and kindly, right, by the people's leaders to say, are you willing to do this? And they kind of have to say yes because they got drafted. And so here we are with the leaders of the people in this 1 out of 10 who have been forced to move here. And yet even that appears to not be enough. And now verse 2 is where I really want to focus. So we've had the leaders who live there, and 1 out of 10 are forced, compelled to come by casting lots. And then 11 verse 2 happens. And the people blessed all the men who willingly offered to live in Jerusalem. Look, some of the other translations here. We'll use the word volunteered. This is the Hebrew word that's often translated volunteered in other places. And the people blessed all the men who willingly offered, who volunteered to live in Jerusalem. It would seem to be that here we have a third group of people. That the leaders are living there, and then 1 out of 10 are compelled to come live. And then you have a third group, those who actually volunteer, willing to offer themselves to give up their homes and live in Jerusalem. And think about what this would require of them, right? Think about those people who are drafted. Some of these families may have returned to Jerusalem a couple generations ago. And they have homes that they've lived in, grown up in. Right? Here they're established in the suburbs in a place that is safe and calm where they know their neighbors, where they probably have farms, they have some sort of a business, they have some sort of a livelihood. And it's one thing for people to have to have been asked by the people of Israel to say, you have been drafted, we need you for the good of the people of Israel, for the good of our relationship with God, for the good of this commitment that we've made to live in relationship with God, you are required to move to Jerusalem. But it's another thing entirely to find this third group of people who willingly offer then to say, we realize you don't have enough there. You still need more. We are willing to leave our homes, to leave our comfortable places where we live, the places maybe where we've established families and where we have relationships with the people and we have farms and we actually have a means of living. We're willing to give up that easy lifestyle and volunteer to move into the city of Jerusalem for the good of God's people. And what a step by these people willing to move and volunteer to go. The Hebrew word used here actually means, when you look at it really literally, means to impel or to invite from within. Right? And inherent in this term is the idea of inner generosity and willingness. Right? That these people were stirred up from deep within, impelled by God to move, and they did. Forsaking what was easy and comfortable to do something difficult, to volunteer their time and their lives for the good of the people. And that's the group here in 11 verse 2. And the people blessed all the men who willingly offered to live in Jerusalem. And now, once again, as Nehemiah has started doing far more often than any preacher would like, we get another list of names. Right, here you have another list of names if you study these names, right, you'll find you have several different lists, right? You have lists of some seem to be individual names, some are family names. Some are groups of people, the chiefs of the people, as we find in verse 3 and following. But as you look through these verses, you find a couple hints as to 5 different areas where people were volunteering to serve. See, look, you find 5 different areas where people volunteered to serve. First of all is the one that we just looked at in verse 2, that we have a group of people who volunteer to willingly move to Jerusalem. Those volunteers, those brave, faithful, nameless people who volunteer to move to Jerusalem, left their homes and moved. Look at verses 10 and 11. We find another area of people volunteering to work, right? Of the priests. The priest, Jediah, the son of Joiarib, Jachin. Ooh, Jachin. I think we know a Jachin, don't we? Oh, sad. He's down with Kingdom Kids. Well, everybody tell Jachin Bunyura that his name came up today. Sariah, the son of Hilkiah, the son of Meshullam, son of Zadok, son of Merioth, son of Ahitub. Ruler of the house of God. It would seem that these priests, right, are those who are rulers, those who are volunteering in the house of God. Here we have the volunteers who are working within God's house, those temple workers. Tons to do, tons of work to do in the temple. So you have those volunteering inside the temple. Then verses 15 and 16, right? And of the Levites, several people, getting down to verse 16, right? And Jozabad, of the chiefs of the Levites who were over the outside work of the house of God. Volunteers who moved, volunteers within the house of God, volunteers who worked outside of the house of God. We're not just talking about like landscaping and sweeping the courts, right, of the Gentiles and stuff. Those who are working outside of the house of God, we're talking about those who probably did a lot of the judging or handled civil affairs, people who counseled and ministered to the public when they weren't within the temple walls. Next, in verse 17, you have an interesting term here, and Mattaniah, the son of Micah, son of Zabdi, son of Asaph, who was the leader of the praise, who gave thanks. Other translations say it seems more like this term should be translated those who led prayers. You have those who are volunteering to pray and praise, right, through giving thanks. Then in verse 22, we have maybe my favorite group. The overseer of the Levites in Jerusalem was Uzi, right? Uzi, the son of Bani, son of Hashabiah, son of Mattaniah, son of Micah, the sons of Asaph, the singers, over the work of the house of God. You actually have a group of volunteers who are the singers. Another translation, right? Those were the clan that became the tabernacle singers, right? The temple singers. The Von Trapps of Hebrew worship, shall we call them. Remember, we have these areas of volunteer, right? Those who willingly volunteer to move, to pick up and move their homes into Jerusalem. Those who volunteer to work within the temple. Those who volunteer to work outside of the temple. Those who volunteer in personal praise and prayer. Those who volunteer here to sing, to lead the singing in the temple. And the restoration of Israel, right? The restoration of Jerusalem would not have been complete without these volunteers, some of whom are named, but many of whom are not. We didn't read them, but we get to numbers that just speak of the brothers who did the work of the house, 822. Right, there you have listed that there were 822 people, 822 volunteers who worked within the temple. Those unnamed volunteers, forgotten, their names are forgotten as far as the history of Israel goes, but surely remembered by God. As you look at it, you realize that this revival, this rebuilding effort, right? None of this would have been possible. Continuing on, none of this effect would have had the long-lasting, right, survival if not for these groups of volunteers willing to move in and live there, willing to lead the worship in the temple and outside, willing to pray, willing to lead the scene. Surely this city of Jerusalem, God's city, would not have stood up to the future enemies who will attack soon, right, if it weren't for the people willing to move and live there. Surely the people would have strayed from their God rather quickly, if not for the people willing to volunteer and lead the worship within and without, to lead the prayer and the singing. And the revival was over, and the excitement maybe began to wane, and we moved the most difficult time, that everyday grind of life in a relationship with God, and these willing volunteers were the key to success. The Jerusalem doesn't stand, and the people of God don't continue to follow these commands if the city of Jerusalem isn't thriving, and these people, these willing, nameless, forgotten volunteers, are the ones who kept it going. And of course, as I think of grace, the parallels are obvious. And we too, in a way, here at Grace, are at a time of renewal or revival. And I really do feel like the leaders are going forward and leading. I am proud of the work that the elders, the deacons, and the ministry leaders are doing right now. They are leading, and we're excited about it. We have this new mission and vision. We have the goals that we want to achieve. Right? And the leaders, the deacons, the ministry leaders, we're excited about where we're headed, and we're leading. But we know we can't do it alone. We need the volunteers. We are but few, and we need those people who are willing to step up and do the everyday, often thankless, unnamed work here at Grace. And there is much work to do, isn't there? And so if you aren't volunteering here at Grace, let me encourage you to step up and get involved. Figure out what you love, what you're passionate about, what your gifts are, and figure out how to serve this body with your gifting. But at the same time, I can't help but smile as I think of Grace because of all the volunteers that we have. Now, one of the beauties of a small church is that, frankly, small churches don't survive if you don't have a lot of people willing to give their time and energy towards it. And I can't help but smile as I think of the many ways in which people are serving in this body. And frankly, we couldn't have gotten here through times of transition and rebuilding. We couldn't have made it even this far if it weren't for the volunteers that we have who are giving time, who have given up their homes in the suburbs to move into the city, so to speak. Those people who are volunteering to lead the singing, who are on their knees praying, who are serving inside of this house of God and outside of this house of God. We have so many volunteers. Think of all those who volunteer on stage, right, leading us in worship. Those who volunteer in the booth, in the back with the tech, those volunteers in the nursery, the ones teaching kids, ones making meals and blankets, right, visiting shut-ins, making communion, mowing the yard, right? There are so many volunteers who are here helping make the work of God possible in this place. And so I want to speak to you volunteers, you many, frankly, who are volunteering. Number one, you are needed. You are needed. Now what you're doing here is important to the family of Grace. Maybe there's a time when holding a child who's crying in the nursery just doesn't feel like you're really contributing to the overall body of Grace, but you are needed. We need those of you who are even simply willing to cut grass that we couldn't have gotten here without you. Jerusalem would not have grown without those volunteering to live and work there, and Grace would not be here preaching the gospel if it weren't for your service to the Grace family. Grace would not be here serving the teen moms if it weren't for you volunteering to keep this place afloat. So you are needed, and I want you to know that. And second, I say this to you volunteers, that you are known. You are known. Maybe not here. Maybe not on earth. Maybe no one will ever know of that thing that you do every week for this church. Maybe no one will ever know that it was you coming and taking the trash out. But you are known in heaven. And I think this is the toughest part of volunteering, isn't it? That being one of those nameless volunteers and never feeling like you're really appreciated. But I want to tell you that you are known. Most of you are known for what you're doing by the elders, and we thank you for your volunteering, and we pray for you. But when you feel like you're not known, and when you feel like it's such a thankless job, I want you to know that you are known, because no matter what, God knows your name, just like He knows the name of the boy who gave the fish and the loaves, just like He knows the names of those shepherds who were there that first night with the Christ child, that you are known. That what you do to serve this family here is known in heaven. The author of Hebrews tells us, God is not unjust so as to overlook your work and the love that you have shown for his name and serving the saints as you still do. That God will not overlook that little thing that you do for grace. That though you may be overlooked at times here on earth, you will never be overlooked by God. And one day, you will be rewarded for every single thing that you did here on earth. For every floor that you swept, every lesson that you taught, every song that you led, God will not overlook you. That you will receive your recognition and rewards in heaven. Because in heaven, rewards are not according to how big you were, how famous you were, but how faithful you were. And so to you volunteers, I say, you are needed and you are known. You are celebrated by God in heaven, and one day you will be rewarded by God in heaven. Those of you who aren't volunteering yet, who aren't serving, I say, serve. Be one of those who says, I want to be a part of what God is doing in this body. Because you know that God's work is happening here, and the word is being preached here, and you are needed. That we need more tech people. We need more people working in that nursery. We need more people teaching kids. Right? It's about to get hot. We're going to need people to mow yards. But find a way to plug in. Not just because you're needed in the end, but also because even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. And we know that just as the people in verse 2, and the people blessed all the men who willingly offered to live in Jerusalem, that God will bless you for your service. And maybe it won't be here, and maybe your name won't be known, but you are known to God in heaven. During World War II, when England needed to increase its coal production, Winston Churchill called together the labor leaders, and he asked them to do this. He asked them to picture in their minds a victory parade which he knew would be held in Piccadilly Circus after the war. And that first in line would be the sailors who kept the vital sea lanes open. And after them would come the soldiers who returned from Dunkirk, then went on to defeat Rommel in Africa. Next would be the pilots who'd driven the Luftwaffe from the skies. And last of all, he said, would come a long line of sweat-stained, soot-streaked men in miners' caps. And someone would shout from the crowd, "And where were you during the critical days of our struggle?" And from 10,000 throats would come the answer, "We were deep in the earth with our faces to the coal." Not all jobs are prominent and glamorous, but those who serve God with their faces to the coal play a vital role in fulfilling his purposes in the earth. And so I imagine the opening parade in heaven, and first will come the martyrs who gave their lives for Christ. And then will come the missionaries who took the good news to every corner of the earth. And then will come the pastors and teachers of the word. And then will come a vast horde of people, and someone from the crowd will cry, "And where were you during the critical days of our struggle on earth?" And from 10 million throats will come the answer, "We were deep in the earth with our faces to the coal, with our hands on a broom, with our knees on the floor in prayer, with our hands holding open lesson plans, and our voices calming distressed infants. We were there, the volunteers who made it possible." Let's pray.